Succession number 27185, reel 34.
Major Barras, reel 34.
You were saying that one of the skills you were expected to acquire at Staff College was making a case.
Yes.
How were you supposed to do that? Was that a verbal case or a case on paper?
Well, it was both, really. They were usually putting forward your views on tactical or strategic situations, on, obviously artificial war problems. Either it was in the big room, big sort of ballroom place where there was a big model in the middle and we all, the whole course sat round it, and you were called upon at any time to get up and give your views on how you thought that somebody who had got himself into a rather sticky position should get himself out, or how you would tackle a certain situation which a battalion commander had come up against. And you'd give your views, and then somebody else would ask if they agreed with it. So perhaps chairs say, no, I don't. I think he ought to have done this, that, and the other first, and I think he's missed something, you know. He ought to have found out more about this than the other. And so it goes on. I mean, people are asked to get up and give their views.
It sounds like a grander version of the syndicate discussions.
It's a big syndicate discussion, actually, yeah. Except it's a little bit more daunting because you have to stand up in this big hall with the whole course there. And very often the sort of commandant would sort of slide in through the back door there and sit behind watching everybody. So you hope that your report, or they didn't make reports at the... Well, I suppose they did make reports, so we didn't know about them. But the summing up of your character at the end of the course didn't depend on one occasion when you were up on your feet in one of these situations.
But presumably you were put on the spot on other occasions, as when you were given senior appointments in the telephone battles.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But then that wasn't making a case so much as actually fighting a battle. And your case, if you had to make one, came afterwards when the post-mortem was done. And if you did something wrong, you'd be asked by the directing staff, as, why did you do this? And then you'd have to say why and satisfy them that you did the right thing. Or you may be criticised and somebody else might get up. Well, he wouldn't get up on that occasion. He'd all be sitting around, and Mum be asked his views, and he again may say, well, I think he ought to have done something. I think we went wrong there. We shouldn't have done that.
It sounds as though it was back to the classroom.
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so. Yeah.
And you also mentioned that there are other nationalities involved in this staff college, including the Poles.
Yeah, there were, I think it was four or five Poles who had come from Italy. Most, in fact, a lot of the students there all came from Italy. There are about four or five of them. They all had long, unpronounceable names, and of course, as the usual British way, they got them shortened and nicknamed. I remember one was called Skylark, because I think his proper name was something like Skilakili Ski or something. And another was called Joe, I remember. And they took it all in good part. In fact, they called each other by these names a lot of the time. But I think most of us found out for the first time that they were very dubious about going home with the Russians there, because we had thought, and I think we sort of talked to them about it, and said, the war's coming to an end, the Germans will be gone. And they said, yes, but the Russians are coming, and they're worse than the Germans. And of course, they'd already heard, I suppose, about the Stalin's trick outside Warsaw on Vistula, where he held up the Russian army, encouraged the rising in Warsaw. The Germans then crushed it and killed about 40,000 of them, or whatever it was. And then old Joe Stalin released his army to occupy Warsaw. So that didn't go down very well. So we felt rather sad for them, actually, because probably a lot of them hadn't seen their families for some time, and it didn't look as if they wanted to go back anyway. But they were the only foreigners I can remember there.
Did you find that those who'd had experience of fighting in Italy had a different cast of mind to you, who'd done your fighting in Northwest Europe?
I can't remember they did, no. Of course, they did have a different... I mean, there's mountainous and crossing rivers, and...
And they'd been in the desert before, many of them.
And some had been in the desert before, yeah. I don't remember anything which was so startling. There may have been come up in conversations, but I think we were dealing with a common... Here, we were dealing with a common problem. And the background was all set, and we had to deal with that as it was.
So you were operating from the same basic principles and ideas?
Yes, it was, yeah.
There was some sort of conformity of view about how to do things? And
well, I wouldn't say it was a conformity of view, but I mean, within certain parameters, certainly, yeah. Mm. I mean, nobody had any wild ideas about doing things, but I have no doubt that sort of original ideas were put out now and again. I mean, the DS were very good. I remember we had one or two well-known people. There was one of the best DS I had was one called Edward Ford from the Grenadiers. Now, he turned up later as equerry to the Queen. I remember seeing his picture or name on the paper. And he was very good. He was excellent. There was another chap called Charteris, who was also... got himself involved with the royal family later, I think. But one of our star pupils was Jellicoe, George Jellicoe, Lord George Jellicoe, son of the Admiral, fresh from his activities in Yugoslavia with his DSO. And in fact, he and I were the youngest ones on the course. I think he was even younger than I was, or just, because you couldn't get in there under 25. In fact, we had quite a number of Grenadiers and Coldstream from Italy there on the course.
Did you have any idea about what would happen to you when you finished at Haifa?
Well, no, I hadn't actually. Nobody had. At the end of the course, towards the end of the course, people were beginning to be called to go and see the commandant, which sent a cold chill down the corridors. When they came back, it was found out that he told them that he was very sorry, but they didn't see that they could they were competent enough to show themselves competent enough to hold a grade 2 staff appointment, and so they had failed. But there were only, I don't know how many there were, and then the word got out that that was it, because everybody knew that everybody was standing on tenterhooks wondering who was going to be sent next.
What was there any sort of common cause of this visit to the headmaster?
No, I knew nothing about it, actually. We just heard about it, that somebody had been sent. They'd come back and said he'd told them that they'd failed. There must have been about half a dozen, I suppose. And then a notice went up on the board there saying, did anybody feel... put down their names if they wanted to go to the Far East. Well, I felt that I'd been since Dunkirk until D-Day 4 days in the UK, and I really felt I should do a bit more, so I put my name down to go to the Far East, and that's where I went. They didn't nobody told me I was going. I mean, I just said I wanted to go, and they accepted it.
When did the postings come through?
Well, my posting never came through until I got out there. I mean, I went out there to RCA headquarters, and there I had to fight my way out of this headquarters to get out onto the ground again. But there were one or two... Sorry, before we leave Palestine, there were one or two things... I mean, I did get around and was able to see some of the places there, Jerusalem, Nazareth, Bethlehem and Galilee and so forth. I was a bit disappointed because they've become rather commercial. As the summer got hot, as it did, a lot of us took our beds up on the roof. Luckily, none of us slept-walked, otherwise, because there were no railings around the side.
Could have gone over the edge.
And the working hours were Middle East ones. In fact, we worked in... early in the morning, and then the afternoon was totally free. And you worked again in the evening. And we didn't indulge very much in what was called Egyptian PT by the troops, which was lying on your bed during the afternoon, which a whole lot of, you know, used to do. We could go down to the beach and swim, or we could go to the local pool. What intrigued me was going down on the beach, which was mostly Jewish people, but they were being guarded by Arab Legion. So each end of the beach, you would see these Arabs with their rifles and the Jewish people all having a swim.
Did you get any sense of the political atmosphere in Palestine?
Oh, yes, definitely. Of course, the Palestine police were excellent, but of course they were mixed. I don't think people realise that. There were Jews and Arabs both working together as police. But it came home, I think. The local girls were very keen to take us out. I don't know how we got to know them. But we used to go on beach parties on the afternoons off or the weekends. And then the first time we went out, we get a sort of recreational truck and take them down. They provide the food, and we had a sort of afternoon there. And then we had to get them home again. But they'd never allow us to drop them outside their homes in case their father saw them and they'd been out with British officers. And that was what came as rather a shock for most of us. I thought, well, gosh, you know, we've been liberating all their countries and so
forth. What were these girls? Were these Jewish girls or Arab
girls?
They're all Jewish girls.
Yes, but we got on very well with the Arabs, much better. I mean, the Jewish girls were fine. They didn't worry us. They didn't worry at all. But on the Arab side, I mean, now and again I'd be walking down the street, and I remember on at least two occasions, if you were in uniform walking down, they'd come up and by your side and say, "I was with Lawrence." Whether they were or not, I don't know. The one I remember most was old enough to have been with Lawrence, because it wasn't too far back from then, of course. And then there were two shops we used to go and eat. One was called Edmonds and the other was called Edwards. They were brothers. Arabs, and we used to go have what we called a scoff, and that was a guard's expression, I think, came from they used to use this expression. And then there were meatless days, so that you couldn't have meat on certain days. And if we went to Edwards and had meat on a day which you shouldn't have meat, and the police got to hear about it, they come and close him down. So they closed him down. So we went off down to Edmonds, down around the corner, and had our food there. But by and large, we found the Arabs were very friendly. The Arabs were sort of, the Jews were more or less distant. They didn't, there was one place where we used to go and play skittles underneath, where the guy was very good, Jewish guy who ran it, and we were quite friendly with him. But I don't remember being friendly with any other of the Jewish fraternity. In fact, if we went and ate in their restaurants, remember they were, the waiters would be around serving us in khaki shorts and khaki shirts, and we all joked that they were going off down to do their training after the restaurant was closed. So the atmosphere was beginning to build up there. You could feel it.
Were there any incidents while you were there?
I don't think so. I don't remember. I remember on one occasion there were some wrens there, where there was a naval station there. I was seeing a wren home one evening, and we were definitely followed by some Jewish men behind. They didn't approach us, but they followed us all the way down the road, which was a bit eerie.
Was there a lot of propaganda being?
No, it didn't reach us. Yeah, because you've got to remember, we were transient. Permanent garrison there knew more about what was going on than we did. I mean, we were just there to attend the staff college. But of course, we went, talking of the Navy, we took a trip out in HMS Javelin, the destroyer there, to give us a bit of knowledge of the Royal Navy. I believe the HMS Javelin is the destroyer which is now being refurbished and
Restored.
Renovated, yeah. Isn't that right? I think so.
I know there was one destroyer restore as an example of the type.
I think we were all terribly impressed by the way the captain stood on the bridge and just kept on saying to his make smoke aft number one or do this number one. But of course he had the responsibility for the whole ship. The other thing I remember there was VE Day. Of course that occurred when we were there, and there was a little sort of bar place up further up Mount Carmel, because where we were was on Mount Carmel halfway up, called the program which we have on television.
Panorama,
that's right. Yes, it was called the Panorama. And somehow or other, the whole course, everybody, including the DS, Geoffrey Elliott, all the cool colonels, not the commons, I say, all congregated there for a party. And this must have started in the afternoon, I suppose, because we got the day off on the VE Day. And about towards the end of the afternoon, somebody decided to have a rugby game there. So we all got down on the floor, took our coats off, and then had scrum down, and somebody got sort of screwed up a whole lot of papers and made a ball out of it. And I think the owner, the Jewish owner, got a little bit panicky, and he thought we were rioting and the place was going to be broken up. And unbeknown to us, he phoned up the military police. Anyway, after a bit, there wasn't anybody drunk or anything. We decided we ought to go home and had enough, so we all put our coats on, dressed up smartly, and cleaned up the place and started to walk out through the door, to the amazement of this proprietor who watched us going out. As we were walking down the hill back to the Telch house, we found the posses of CMP coming up the hill in 1500 weight trucks. And they said, I can remember one saying, "Where's the riot?" And we said, "Oh, it's up there, you know."
Sent them on their way.
Yes, and they only found one chap there asleep. Oh, Philip Luce from the RESC, I remember. He always had heavy eyelids. He must have had a lot of trouble keeping them up most of the time. But they found him curled up on a chair there asleep, picked him up gingerly, tenderly picked him up and brought him back. And that was it.
When did you actually make the move from Haifa out to the Far East?
Well, they sent me home.
They sent you home to England?
Yeah, for embarkation leave, or disembarkation from Palestine, and embarkation before I went out. So I was on the train again down to Cairo, with more eggs of bread on the way. I then got, they flew me home, and I remember we had hydraulic trouble. I think we'd landed at a place called El Adam.
It's in Libya, isn't it?
Yes,
Tripoli.
Yes, we landed there and had to mend the hydraulics. I just remember this. And then we were flown home to Lynham, I think it was, and I had 2 weeks' leave. And then I was called forward again to fly out to the Far East.
Did they ring church bells again at Kenbury?
No. Not in this, well, because I passed the staff college course.
And you'd come home from the war again.
Well, I come home from a staff college then, because I had been home prior to that. The only thing that, of course, one was delighted with was when I had those magic letters PSC after your name. So that was something we felt delighted to do, have. So I had 2 weeks, 2 weeks leave. I can't remember whether I had to go to the transit centre in London again or whether I went straight down to Lynham. But there were about two or three of us on the course, apart from myself, who had said they wanted to go to the Far East. And there were one or two others who were in the UK who were going out there as well. And we were stuffed into this York aircraft down at Lynham with cargo all the way down the centre, great big crates lashed to the ground, and round them someone had thoughtfully put mattresses. I mean, you can imagine it today, can't you? And we got into the aircraft and just lay on the mattresses and were able to sit up and look out of the window.
Sounds like the air equivalent of a tramp steamer.
Yes, yes, definitely steerage.
What route did you take then?
Well, we went from there to Basra. Well, we must have called somewhere else before that, but I remember landing in Basra, where it was an RAF station then, and it was boiling hot. And we went into a tin mess there with a fan sort of going slowly around in the roof, being given hot big steaks. However, from there we went to Karachi, and I remember they opened the door, and it was like opening an oven door because of the heat coming straight off the desert.
Is it worse than Basra?
Well, it was a different kind of heat, you see. It was a dry heat. Basra was humid and sweaty. This one was a sort of blast of really hot, like, as I say, opening the oven. From there, we went down to Colombo. And we were debussed there, so to speak, and put in a transit camp. At least I was. I don't know what happened to the others after this. I was put in a transit camp in the jungle somewhere near the airport. It was a sort of temporary thing made of local material. And I must have been there for, I don't know, several days. And I remember I could look out of the window there, or walk past through a window, and the kitchen for the mess was below, just below, with a sort of shelter over the top. And there were monkeys that used to come down and sort of nick bananas and stuff off there. So one day I saw a dog coming down, was walking past the kitchen there, and a monkey came down from a tree somewhere, ran up behind the dog, got hold of both of its back legs and threw it on its back, and then disappeared up the tree again. And I've never seen such an astonished dog. He got up, looked around, there was nobody there. He couldn't work it out at all. Anyway, after a bit, I was summoned to ALSI headquarters, which was up in Kandy at that time. Of course, Mountbatten had his supreme headquarters in the Botanical Gardens in Colombo. and I went up to ALSI headquarters where they, you see, apparently having said I'd want to go out to the Far East, they said, OK, you can go out there and they'll fit you up with a job when you get there. So they tried to give me a job there, and I was absolutely horrified. I'd never seen anything like this before. It was like a great big sort of office. Well, it was. Offices blocked, and there wasn't a soldier to be seen anywhere.
What sort of job did they want to give you?
Well, I have no idea. I can't even remember. I said I wanted to get out and out to Burma and with the troops there somewhere. So, of course, what had happened, peace had come.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you where you were when the war came to an end. You were in London.
And the 16th of August, I was trying to fight my way across London, where the King and the Queen were doing a little victory roll down the road. Fight my way through the crowds to Paddington Station, I think. But what I did do was to phone the War Office when I heard that the peace had been declared and coming, to say I'd changed my mind. And they said, too bad.
You're on the way.
Yes. And,
Do you remember what your first thoughts were when you heard about the use of the atomic bombs?
No. I must have been at home, I suppose, at that time. Yes, I was. I can't remember a thing about that leave, actually. I can't remember. I mean, obviously, we were all for it. I mean, there was no...
no moral qualms about...
Not a bit, no. I mean, they were being a brutal lot holding down there. Everybody all over the Far East, they've been brutal to our people. If we tried to occupy it or fight our way in Japan, we were going to get a mass of casualties. Oh, nobody had at that time. It was rather like Bomber Command. I mean, at that time when Bomber Command went over and bombed Germany, nobody had any qualms at all about it. We used to cheer. We could hear them going out at night and give them a cheer on the way. It's terrible to think of it now. I mean, of the people that died and the civilians and children and God knows what. But when you get yourself involved in a total war like that with really brutal enemies, both of them, the Nazis and the Japanese, you have to do everything you can to bring it all to a conclusion in your favour. So, no, I don't remember. So anyway, they said after a bit, they said, well, there's one job going out there if you really want to go out there. And they said it's a G2 intelligence of 19th headquarters, 19th Indian Division.
Were they surprised that you were anxious to go out?
Oh, I can't remember what their reaction was, really. It shouldn't have been. So I grasped it with both hands, not knowing what it was all about. All I knew, I was going to be with a division. And I then had to wait. I was then sent down to Colombo from Kandy. And I can't remember, I was stationed somewhere in Colombo, because I remember we used to go to the Goreface Hotel, which was the big hotel on the front there. I was so pleasantly surprised at the neatness of the place and the cleanliness of the place, which it doesn't have now, of course, but all the European houses were just like those in suburbia here. We've got their houses and their gardens, and the streets were clean. You walked into Colombo and there were departmental stores there. And a lot of jewellery, a lot of stones on sale. You had to be very careful. You weren't buying cheap reflectors, as somebody said. And I found the people there very, very helpful and very pleasant indeed. I couldn't accuse them of Teutonic efficiency, but on the other hand, they always wanted, as far as I can remember, they always wanted to help, and they all smiled, and we felt perfectly safe there. There was no sort of feeling of animosity from them at all. So I was then put in an aeroplane, which I don't remember, and flew to Calcutta, which I don't remember, landing at Dum Dum Airport. And there I had to, we were taken into Calcutta town or city, to the Grand Hotel on the Chowringhee, I think it was. This was the main street there. I think it was on the Chowringhee. And there the movement control people had an office. And I think they must have taken over the whole hotel for accommodation purposes and so forth. I reported there to an Indian officer, movement control, and he said, there's nothing doing at the moment. You have to report here every day to find out what the chances of getting you down to Rangoon, because we went by ship. There was a big trooping program from Calcutta to Rangoon, all ferrying backwards and forwards. And he said, there's no room here, so I'm going to put you in with Mrs. Dickens. So to further down the road. So I reported to Mrs. Dickens, who was an English lady. I don't know whether she was widowed or whether her husband had run off with a local lady or not. Anyway, she took in, acted as an annex for officers waiting in transit. And I was ushered into a fairly largest room where there were five other chaps. And they got there. We got three beds aside with our mosquito nets. And that was my base for, I don't know, it must have been nearly 2 weeks, I think. And every day I had to go down to the Grand Hotel. But before leaving Colombo, somebody had very kindly given me a note to a girl they knew who was stationed in Calcutta from the Fannies. Soon after I got there, I put on my best bib and tucker and went off and presented my note, and she turned out to be a charming girl. But it did give me the opening to meet other people there. So I met not only Fannies, but a whole lot of chaps who were there. And they used to take me down to the clubs, and there was the Saturday Club, I remember, which was a sort of watering hole for the local Raj. Which had a swimming pool and a bar, and a very pleasant to get out of the heat, because it was very sticky then. One travelled by rickshaw most of the time. And then there was the Tolly Gunge Club, which was really for the super sabs. I mean, it really was. It was a very well, right in the middle of Calcutta, but you went in through the gates. This lovely building and huge lawns and woods and so forth behind, and you could sit under the trees and have tea with minor birds popping up and standing on the tables. I mean, they were speaking in Hindi, I didn't understand what they were saying. But that was very pleasant, and you could swim. But the only place, I never found any any animosity there.